Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Well, I've been bewildered for the last couple of days because I haven't known how to publicly thank Chris Fuccini for doing what she did. And here she is, and I can say in front of everybody, thank you so much for doing such an incredible, I don't know what to call it. There's no word for it. But it was big and sweet and made a lot of people very happy, including me. So I know not everybody got to go to the party, but Chris put together a really stupendous, very low-key, very sweet day in the Redwoods, where there was time for everything, for talking and playing frisbee and playing cards and taking long walks in the woods, and it was just the best. Just the best. And Samia made it the most delicious cake anybody ever ate in their life. Yes, truly. So let's do introductions around, because I'm not sure everybody knows everybody.
Wendy.
Jeffrey.
Colin.
Roy.
Chris. Marie.
Judy. Kelly.
Paul.
Nico.
Still so excited about that party. We're starting a new subject, and this is it, the Vimalakirti Sutra. It's one of the most essential texts that we study, so-called study, though we don't really study in Zen. It's one of the teachings that comes to us with a tremendous sense of humor. And it comes to us as from a lay person, having a very funny situation when he's in bed, sick, and entertains all the bodhisattvas and the Buddha and has conversations with various ones of them about practice. And so although it's a very practice-oriented document, you could say, it tells the teaching in a way that makes it not so sound so esoteric, so out there somewhere. It's very, very realistic. Even in this first chapter, Shariputra gets put right in his place for getting too woo-woo about everything. Mm-hmm. and it's a great beginning. It's very ancient, they think, though they don't know where it came from. They think it was originated around the turn of the millennium, between B.C. and A.D., or whatever we call those now. And in about at about 400 or so, there was a wonderful translation by Kumarajiva, who created it in such a way that it became very popular, and then became translated and went all over the Southeast Asia. Everybody loved this sutra. It's not really a sutra. The sutra is supposed to be a preaching by Buddha, usually from Vulture Peak, And Buddha is here, and Buddha is actually doing some of the preaching, but it's not like the other ones where... well, it has a different flavor, I would say. Although all the teachings are there. In fact, in this first chapter, it sort of wraps the whole thing up in a little package just so we know what a bodhisattva really is. There are many versions of this. Robert Thurman has a wonderful translation and a great introduction. I was thinking I might copy the introduction and pass it out to everybody because it's really good. He has the Vajrayana view, the Tibetan view, as well as the Mahayana. And he finds very much Vajrayana in this, in the way that it projects and presents form and emptiness, in a sort of Nagarjuna style. It's this, no, it's neither one, you can't say. It's something in the middle, but you can't say that either. It's that sort of thing. So, Burton Watson did this a long time ago. Thomas Cleary has a brand new book out of the Vimalakirti Sutra, and it's only available in Kindle. You have to have a Kindle, and you have to be able to download it. So it's not extremely available unless you happen to have a Kindle, which is great for Amazon, of course, but for the rest of us. Luckily, my son was visiting, and he was appalled by my Kindle, which I've had for 15 years, or whenever the Kindle first came out. And so he took me to Best Buy, and I now have a new Kindle with Thomas Cleary in it. And that's been very interesting because I've been comparing Burton Watson's translation with Cleary. And Cleary's is much more poetical. It's the way, it sounds like the Lotus Sutra because he puts more into it than Burton Watson does. He just enjoys the sound of the names of all of the things that are the people and creatures that are there, the bodhisattvas who show up with all those incredible fancy names. And so he makes more of it than Watson does. But they're pretty much exactly the same otherwise. They really are. Cleary calls it the purification of Buddha fields. And Watson just calls it Buddha lands. So you can see already there's a difference. Of course, it is about Buddha lands, but it is about the action of it is the purification. What it is that makes a Buddha land pure. What is a Buddha land? Buddha land. How can we have a Buddha land in this messy world we live in? How is that even possible? I have a book that's secondhand and that somebody has already made notes in it, so it's if I get mixed up, that's why. So there's a great assembly because there's always a great assembly. And it's always jillions and jillions of people who come, and all kinds of people. There were 8,000 leading monks, 32,000 bodhisattvas, and then they were not only spotless and pure, Having rid themselves of snares and obstructions, their minds constantly resided in a state of unhindered emancipation. So obviously it's a state of mind. It isn't a place. They had learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at, no view of phenomena to be entertained. They knew how to respond compliantly to others and to turn unregressing the wheel of the law. Experts in comprehending the characteristics of phenomena, able to understand the capacities of living beings, they towered over the others of the great assembly and had learned to be fearful of nothing. It's a great introduction. So this is all, this whole first few pages is a description of the kind of people that the bodhisattvas have become.
Bye.
Having disciplined their minds and rejected the worldly embellishments. I love that, the worldly embellishments. They had profound faith, diamond-like in its firmness. They'd plumbed the depths of dependent origination, how everything is connected to everything else. There is nothing separate. And cut off all erroneous views, no longer entertaining the concepts either of being or non-being. Bring up being, you have to bring up non-being, and then where are you? Nowhere. It doesn't add up. There was no measuring them, for they had passed beyond measure. They were like practice pilots at sea. They'd master all the profound and subtle meanings of the doctrines and were expert in perceiving the past and future existences of living beings and the workings of their minds. So then it goes on to a list of who they were. Bodhisattva viewing equality, bodhisattva viewing inequality, bodhisattva viewing equality and inequality, etc., etc. It's quite long, the list. It goes all the way down the page. And after these 32,000 bodhisattvas, there were also 10,000 Brahma kings who had come from the other four continent worlds. So more than one world. To visit the place where the Buddha was and listen to the Dharma. There were also 12,000 Indras, gods, who'd come from other four continent worlds, and heavenly beings of great authority as well as. And this is where Cleary goes into world guardian deities, rainmaker spirits, celestial musicians, titans, rocks, minotaurs, and serpents. They all arrived at Buddha's feet. And then Buddha, like a mountain, resting at ease in his lion seat clustered with jewels, shining, blazing, radiant on the lion seat, filled with beauty. A man comes along named Jeweled Accumulation, Jeweled Accumulation, the son of a wealthy man of that city, with 500 other sons of wealthy men, and they all brought parasols with them. This is so funny. They had little parasols, each one adorned with the seven treasures. Bowing their heads in obeisance before the feet of the Buddha, they joined in offering their parasols as alms to the Buddha. Please take my parasol. And the Buddha, with supernatural powers, then caused all the jeweled parasols to come together and form one single parasol that spread over the entire 1,000,000,000-fold world. All the vast features of that world were visible there in its midst. All the mountains of the world, snow mountains, Muchalinda mountains, Maha Muchalinda mountains, great iron encircling mountains, huge seas and rivers, watercourses, brooks and streams, as well as the suns, moons, stars, constellations, and heavenly palaces. Everything under this one great umbrella. At that time, they'd never seen anything like it. So each one, in the presence of the Buddha, recited verses of praise. And then there's a long string of praise verses saying how wonderful Buddha is in all these many, many different ways. No I, no doer, no recipient. Yet greed and bad karma never cease to function. Beneath the Buddha tree, you used your might to overpower the devil. Gaining the sweet dew of nirvana, you won your way to enlightenment. So they tell the story of Buddha and praise of him and his effort, his great effort. He said, now we offer these little parasols to the world-honored one, and in them is revealed to us the 3,000 worlds. So after all the praise, the rich man's son finished reciting the verses and said to Buddha, all these guys have set their minds on enlightenment. They want to hear how one can purify the Buddha lands. And we beg for an explanation of the practices. And the Buddha was very excited and very pleased about this. Excellent, excellent. For the sake of the bodhisattvas, you do right to ask the Thus Come One about the practices for purifying the lands. Listen well. And so they made ready to listen. The Buddha said, jewel accumulation. The various kinds of living beings are in themselves the Buddha lands of the bodhisattvas. It is by converting various beings to the teachings that the bodhisattvas acquire their Buddha lands. It is by persuading various beings and overcoming their objections that the bodhisattvas acquire their Buddha lands. It is by inducing the various living beings to enter into the Buddha wisdom in such and such a land that they acquire their Buddha lands. It's by inducing the various living beings to develop the capacity for bodhisattva practices in any land that they acquire their Buddha lands. Why is this? Because bodhisattva's acquisition of a pure land is wholly due to having brought benefit to living beings. The only reason. It says, so it's like trying to build a house in the air. It doesn't work. You have to build it on the ground. So you build it where everybody is, where we are all together. He said, the vow to acquire Buddha lands is not founded on emptiness. He said, you should understand that an upright mind is the pure land of the Bodhisattva. Or Cleary calls it the realm of intention. To have them having set the intention for enlightenment. Everything is built on that. Being willing for that. And then he goes on to make a long list of all the different kinds of minds that a bodhisattva has. Deeply searching mind, a mind that aspires to enlightenment, almsgiving, keeping the precepts, forbearance, assiduousness, meditation, wisdom. And maybe those sound familiar because they're the paramitas, the bodhisattva practices that we have carried through to this very day. They're all very simple. How to be strong, willing to be strong, how to be generous, how to be kind. And then there are more, the four immeasurables, the four methods of winning people. Expedient means are the pure land of the bodhisattva. The 37 elements of the way are the pure land of the bodhisattva, etc., etc. A mind intent on transferring merit to others is the pure land of the bodhisattva. The will to fully evolve is the way Cleary translates that. The will to fully evolve, not get stuck somewhere. Keep going, keep growing. Teaching others to avoid the eight difficulties is the pure land of the bodhisattva. Observing the precepts himself but not taxing others for not keeping them. I like that one a lot. It's so tempting, isn't it? He says, because bodhisattva has an upright mind, he is impelled to action. And because he's impelled to action, he gains a deeply searching mind. And because he's impelled to action, because he has a deeply searching mind, his will is well controlled. And because of that, he acts in accord with the teachings. And because of that, he can transfer merit to others. And because of that, he knows how to employ expedient means. Because he knows how to do that, he can lead others to enlightenment. And because of that, his Buddha land is pure. Because his Buddha land is pure, his preaching of the law is pure. Because his preaching is pure, his wisdom is pure. And because of that, his mind is pure. And because his mind is pure, all the blessings he enjoys will be pure. So pure means a lot of activity. It's not just waiting in some kind of blissful state to get all cleaned up. It means really getting to work, setting the intention, and keeping it. So here comes Shariputra. He is very moved by this. And he thinks to himself, if the mind of the bodhisattva is pure, then his Buddha land will be pure. Now, when the world-honored one first determined to become a bodhisattva, surely his intentions were pure. So why is this Buddha land, where he is now, such a mess? Why is it filled with impurities? Ugh, horrible world. It's got all these icky things in it. Shariputra replied, "No, world-honored one, that is the fault of the blind man." Are the sun and moon impure? What do you think? Is that why the blind man fails to see them? No. No, the sun and moon are not to blame. So the failing of living beings that prevent them from seeing the marvelous purity of the land of the Buddha. The thus come one is not to blame, Shariputra. This land of mind is pure, but you fail to see it. At that time, one of the kings, the Brahma kings, said to Shariputra, "You must not think that this Buddha land is impure, because to my eyes, Shakyamuni Buddha's land is pure and spotless as the palace of the heavenly being, Great Freedom." Shariputra said, "When I look at this land, I see it full of gnarls and hollows, thorny underbrush, sand and gravel, dirt, rocks, many mountains, filth and defilement." The Brahma king said, "It's just that your mind has highs and lows and does not rest on Buddha wisdom." Isn't that nice? Your mind has highs and lows and does not rest on Buddha wisdom. Therefore, you see this land as impure, Shariputra. The Bodhisattva treats all things and beings, each one of them, with perfect equality. His deeply searching mind is pure, and because it rests on Buddha wisdom, it can see the purity of this Buddha land. The Buddha then, Burton Watson says, pressed his toe. Cleary says he hit the earth with his toe. And immediately the thousand millionfold world was adorned with hundreds and thousands of rare jewels till it resembled jeweled adornment, Buddha's jeweled adornment land of immeasurable blessings. All the members of the assembly sighed in wonder at what they'd never seen before. And they all saw themselves sitting on jeweled lotuses. They could see it. Buddha said to Shariputra, "My Buddha land has always been pure like this. But I wish to save those persons who are lowly and inferior, and I make it seem like an impure land, full of defilements, that's all." In this case, when a person's mind is pure, he'll see the wonderful blessings that adorn this land. And so everybody was able to grasp the truth of birthlessness, and 84,000 people all set their minds on attaining enlightenment. Buddha then released the supernatural power that he had exercised with his toe, and the world returned to its former appearance. One of the notes that came with this is they circled the toe when it's mentioned. And on the side it says, "Ha ha." I don't know that it was a friendly laugh or a cynical laugh. Or so that is the beginning of this story. Are there questions? Comments? I encourage you all to read this if you possibly can. Paul?
Well, it's definitely Indian.
Definitely.
Chinese or Japanese, exactly, that flower in any way.
No.
you know, we read Elgin, it's just...
Yes. And
that has to be Indian. With all these flourishes and all this stuff. Completely different. I love it. It's really neat. But it's really hard to go and listen to it and pick out the things that are common to what the Japanese and the Chinese say. There's a comment about sharing merit.
Mm.
Reminds me of Bodhidharma. No merit.
Yes.
So,
well, the
merit
whole...
No merit.
Exactly. Merit is a very big subject, philosophical subject in Mahayana Buddhism.
Yeah,
and that's...
The emperor wanted to know.
Right.
He built all these temples, but merit didn't gain.
Yes.
Bodhidharma says none.
Right. Right.
So there he's talking about sharing merit. So.
Because that's how merit works, that you share merit. You give it away.
Right. Like a potlatch.
It's like a potlatch, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great subject, that whole thing.
Yeah.
The Tibetans always dedicate the merit of whatever is accomplished every time they meet together. You know, we could do that, dedicate the merit of this meeting tonight to the benefit of all beings. And I like that. I like that whole... It's, again, an intention toward benefiting others. Yeah. Anything else? Karen?
I'm a little confused on it. I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
When they're talking about, you know, the pure land, are they talking about what they see? And if you don't see a pure land, then you're just not there yet. And it's not perspective. It's just, or is it?
Well, in a way, you could say it's perspective. It's how you're able to see what you see. Because we have a mind, and the mind is full of judgments. We're always trying to pick out the things that are safe for us and the things that are not, the things that taste good and then we like, and the things that we just think are icky and that we don't like. Our mind is programmed, you could say, or organized in that way for our survival. And so one of the things that happens is we get stuck in that mode and think that's the way the world is, even though the world isn't like that. And we discover it when we sit. If we sit for any length of time and then get up and go outside and look around, it's really different. It's a different experience. You'll suddenly see how the sparkle of water on the leaves is shining. You can hear the sounds of things as a kind of music. It all becomes another kind of world because you have dropped that judgmental mind. It doesn't go away, and you need it because you need to know when to stop at a red light. But if you just think that's the only kind of mind, then you're stuck in an imaginary world. Because the real world is the world we see, the pure world. Sometimes we get a hint of it. And that's why we sit. Thank you. Well, it's 8. Are there any announcements?
So
I have an announcement. It's your... So we're just going to... We'll be fine-tuning a few forms over the coming months, I think. So one thing is, when we bow, we face the altar and then we chant. We turn and face each other. That's what we... So face altar, bow, bow, bow. Get your chant stuff, face each other, and then put the chant stuff away and face the altar, bow, bow, bow. So that way we can hear each other.
And if you line up facing each other like this, then the voices blend and you lose the sense of yourself as you hear all the voices as one voice. And that's a very wonderful experience.
So when you're bowing, you face the altar. So you just turn. The altar. But then when we're chanting, in between the each set of bows, we turn and face each other. Like we do when we, show to each other.
I have more questions.
One at a time. we're taking this in baby steps.
Very wise.
Thank you.
I just have a short announcement that there's some extra flyers about Sashid, in case you didn't get one in the mail up by the bulletin board in the atrium or whatever it is.
Coming up.
1 minute sit.
1 minute sit.